Thank you so much. Boy, I sound old, but it has been 40 years, honestly. It's just very heartwarming, heartwarming to see so many familiar faces in the audience, and some I haven't seen in a long time, so I hope you'll stay afterwards so that I can say hello. And it's exciting to see so many new faces, and even folks I know who came from other institutions across town and made the long trek down here, so I appreciate that as well. I also see a lot of providers, service providers I know in this community, and I see a lot of parents. So this is quite a mixed audience. I appreciate you being here. Unfortunately, it's always easier to do this in front of strangers than it is in front of people you actually know. And I was told once the best way to get over that is to look for a smiling face in the audience. So all of you who know me, if you'll just keep smiling for the next hour, we'll be in good shape here. And I hopefully the equipment will work as well. I do need to give thanks to a couple of people because this has really been a collaborative development. I want to thank Dr. Don Kalbreth, who's a retired professor of chemistry, who is actually in Cancun this week rather than being here for the presentation. But he's been my science advisor because I'm really an educator, and a lot of what I do is just trying to interpret the science so that those of us who work with children or raise children but don't necessarily understand the science background can access it a little more easily. And I also want to thank my husband, Dr. Randy Williams, who's on the faculty in special education at Gonzaga University, because what we're presenting tonight is just one chapter in a book that we are doing about autism treatment programs. And so he's been deeply involved in that work for the last couple of years. I am very lucky this year to be the Edward B. Lindemann Chair. This is a position that was made in honor of Edward B. Lindemann, who was a former president of Whitworth University when it was still a college. He was a very influential speaker, and he was a futurist. I did not ever get to meet Dr. Lindemann. However, I do feel a link with him because prior to coming to Whitworth, he was the director of the Apollo program with North American Rockwell. And my husband, who was a high schooler at the time, was one of the North American Rockwell Explorers, a club that got to work with the scientists who were there. This was in the 60s when it was in vogue to try to squash as many people as you could into a telephone booth or a Volkswagen or whatever other small space was nearby. And his group actually were able to get 16 high schoolers into the Apollo capsule. And when he mentioned that to the scientists there, they said, "Ah, you broke our record. We could only get 13 scientists into the Apollo capsule." And somehow I like to think of Dr. Lindemann as one of those scientists who was not only a brilliant thinker, but also knew how to have some fun. I know, just give me a show of hands, how many of you are parents of children with autism? Raise them up high, be proud, okay. How many of you are service providers or work with, okay, thank you very much. How many of you are maybe just curious about autism? You're here to learn a little bit more tonight about autism. Thank you. I'm going to do a very quick review of the characteristics of autism because most of you in the audience don't need that background, but just to keep in mind or to introduce some of you who are new to this and what's involved. Autism is a profound and poorly understood developmental disorder. Severely impairs a person's abilities, particularly in the area of language and social relations. And forgive me if I read some of these quotes, but we are audio recording this for an audience who's not here to see all the slides. Autistic children typically are normal in appearance and physically well-developed. Their disabilities range from profound to mild. Their most distinctive feature, however, is that they seem isolated from the world around them. And that's probably the popular description with which you're familiar. However, when we diagnose autism, we look for disabilities in three main areas. One is the failure to develop normal social interactions. A second is either abnormal development of language or no development of language, and particularly for communication, so even being able to gesture, not just speech. And the third is a restricted range of interests and behaviors. And there we're talking about a really obsessive or compulsive need to stay with the same activity or cling to the same objects or be interested in the same topics and so on. In order to diagnose autism, we look for symptoms occurring before the age of 3. However, they usually are present much earlier. There are some people just beginning to diagnose at 14 months, but we've done research with videotapes of children on the first birthdays and looking for what are the distinct differences even at 12 months of age where we might be able to identify a child with autism. About one-third of children with autism seem to begin their life very normally. They even develop speech and may have a few words and so on, and then seem to lose those skills, lose their language, lose the socialization that they had earlier developed, and we say that they have regressed. There is a wide range in severity from mild to very severe. So two children with autism don't often look exactly alike. Sometimes they will have other characteristics as well. They don't test very well on IQ tests and may have problems with learning and cognition. They may have unusual sensory sensitivities, and those will vary. So a child may be what we call tactilely defensive, not like to be touched, may not like certain tastes, may like sounds that you find very disturbing, may be very disturbed by sounds that you find very common and familiar. They sometimes have deficits in joint attention. And by this we mean they lack that ability to draw your attention to some object or activity that they are interested in. I always explain to my students it's a little bit like my dog. If I am eating at the table, the dog looks at the food, looks at me, looks at the food, looks at me. And I say he's sending me psychic messages like drop some of that on the floor, drop some of that on the floor. But often children with autism don't have that ability for joint attention, which would be really one of our earliest ways of communicating. Very often they have seizure disorders, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And sometimes as individuals with autism age and enter young adulthood, they have a higher likelihood of other psychiatric disorders such as depression and schizophrenia. Many individuals with autism have sleep disturbances such that their parents may find they have to lock them in their rooms at night or sleep with them in their rooms so that they don't wander and hurt themselves during the night when other people would be asleep. They may have eating problems, have very limited food preferences. I've known a lot of children with autism who would only eat beige or white food, for example. And an English muffin was great, but don't put tomato sauce on it. It's all over. They have what we call deficits in mind reading. And by that, what we really mean is they don't understand what other people are feeling. So they may know that they're sad if their toy is broken, but they see someone else with a broken toy. They don't know how that person feels. They don't understand that concept. And sometimes, especially if they have not had intensive early intervention, they can develop aggressive behaviors and self-injury where they actually hurt themselves. We now talk about autism as a continuum, the autism spectrum disorder, and the boxes up here are not necessarily in order of severity, but just to show you that a lot of things can be included in that autism spectrum disorder. We include pervasive developmental delay, which I put into plain English as saying it means you're really slow to develop in a lot of areas, which might include your speech and language and learning and even motor control. We also have autism itself, which is most familiar to most people. We have Asperger's syndrome included on the spectrum, which is really a little bit different with typically intellectual development is fine. Socialization is the difficulty there, and there may be some obsessive interest in particular topics. And then I'd like to talk about this other aspect. This has been suggested in the readings. That very last box is broader autism phenotype. And just talk a little bit about the research on that. There is a theory that it may be that the relatives of people who are on the autism spectrum disorder may have some characteristics that would be related to the child's characteristics. And I don't by any means want you to infer that means that they are disabled. It may mean that they're very highly successful, but you could see a relationship. Perhaps engineers, high-tech people, analytical people, mathematicians, and so on, in that they may be compulsive about their organization, their routine. They may have some very passionate interests and be able to concentrate on something for long periods of time. In fact, we've seen, has been reported, some high rates of cases of autism spectrum disorder in the Silicon Valley and among Microsoft workers. In fact, Microsoft was the first corporation in the United States whose insurance policy would cover that 40-hour-a-week one-on-one therapy for children with autism because the rate was so high among their engineers. And within their own magazines, they'll even put out articles and sometimes refer to it as geek syndrome and other things. And this might include Asperger's as well as autism. However, actually, when we did give measures of communication socialization to the parents and of children in families where there was more than one case of autism, they actually did rate higher on that than people who did not have children with autism. Okay. The main question these days has been the increasing rate of diagnosis of autism. This quote is from Bernard Rimlin, who was the father of a child with autism and was a very famous advocate for people with autism. My son Mark was born in 1956. It was obvious from birth that this perfectly normal-looking infant had something drastically wrong with him. I had earned my PhD in experimental psychology 3 years earlier and had never encountered the word autism. Our pediatrician with 35 years of experience had never heard of autism either. Autism was extremely rare then. It is extremely common now. This was in the year 2000. I worked with my first child with autism in 1969. And at that time, very few people knew much about it. The people I worked with were institutionalized or they were in very highly specialized programs to receive services. Otherwise, most of them were closeted at home and didn't receive any kinds of educational services. Now, if I share this information with my sister, my brother-in-law, the man on the street, everybody knows someone with autism. So it has become far more common. But is the increase real? That is one of the major questions that we have to answer. There have been large increases for children with autism, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. So pretty much any country that is keeping track of how many kids who have autism have been reporting increases in autism. It's important that we discern whether this increase is real or not. Because of the size of the increase that's reported, it could not be completely explained just by genetic inheritance. And if the increase is real, then it must be due to some environmental factors. And if that is the case, then we want to identify those factors so that we can contain them and reduce the rate of autism if that's possible. So one of the first pieces of the science that I want to bring to you is evidence of whether we do have a rising incidence or prevalence of autism. Since the 1960s, there have been more than 50 surveys estimating the rate of autism in defined populations. And meta-analysis of this was done. That means you take all the studies, you try to figure out which ones were really good, well-controlled studies, and you look closely at those. You throw out ones that you think were not very well-controlled, were not great studies. And then you try to see what are the majority of the studies agreeing on, what findings are being replicated. And what we have seen, even if we just put together the data that we have from the United States and from the United Kingdom, but remember, we also have data from other countries around the world. In terms of autism spectrum disorder, the whole continuum, we have seen a tenfold increase. Between the 1950s to 1980s, we would have said 5 to 10 children out of 10,000 would have fallen on this continuum. From the 1990s to the 2000s, we're saying it's more like 50 to 80 children out of 10,000. There also has been increasing rates of autism by itself, just that one box on the continuum in terms of data from the United Kingdom and from the United States. And those rates have continued to increase in the last 10 years, and even increase at a rate much faster than the increase of other kinds of disabilities. So if we look at just the rate of autism alone, we also see about a tenfold increase. In the 1970s in the United States, we would have said 3 out of 10,000, I think that is. And in the 80s in the UK, we would have said 10 out of 10,000. And now in the 1990s in the US and UK, it's much higher. The figure that's being used by the Centers for Disease Control now is that 1 out of 150 8-year-olds in this country will fall on the autism spectrum disorder, on the spectrum. Not all of them having autism, but 1 out of 150 having something related to autism, if not autism. There are as many as 560,000 Americans under the age of 21 with autism spectrum disorder. If we look at the data the federal government has collected in terms of our educational system, and these data have only been analyzed up to 2003 on this graph, you will see the red line represents children age 6 to 21 who are in the educational system who have been diagnosed with autism, and you'll see it rising across the years. The blue line, which starts in more recent years, includes children from 3 to 21 because of mandated services for serving children over age 3 now, and you'll see that the increases continue. One thing that I would point out is 1994, which is down here in the low end of the graph, is the last time that the criterion for diagnosing autism was changed. And there's a lot of debate about whether that change in how we diagnosed autism made the difference in increasing the rate. But you'll notice now we're like 14 years later and we're continuing to see a rising increase in the rate. Every state in the United States has reported increase in the number of students diagnosed with autism. And it has continued to increase every year since we started these data in 1991. I also put this graph in, which is from the federal school system, which shows you how autism increases in autism compared to increases in the other disabilities that are also served under our special education system on which we take data. So this is just an accumulation of increases across the year. The little red line that stays fairly level at the bottom is the rate of increase across all the other conditions that we work with, including learning disabilities, mental retardation, physical disabilities, and so on. None of them are increasing at the rate at which the autism is being reported. Now, those are the data that the scientists have gathered, but we have to take that all with a grain of salt. So all the science that I'm going to share with you, I will also talk to you a little bit about why you have to be cautious in how you interpret those data. Our concern about autism is it's a subjective diagnosis. I can't take a sample and send it off to a lab. I can't even do a genetic screen to tell you whether you have autism or not. What I do is I observe your behavior, I get reports from your parents, and if you meet so many symptoms on my list of possible symptoms, I say, you know, I think you have autism, or you have something on the autism spectrum. And that's how I make the diagnosis. So it's fairly subjective. There's no cut and dried test to tell me. Even the condition of autism is somewhat hypothetical. We used to see a lot of children that had these kinds of behaviors, and we decided, let's call them autistic. And now anybody else that looks like them, we'll call them autistic too. So it's not as if we could say, yes, you have leukemia. What we have, again, is sort of a hypothetical category that we've been putting children into. The characteristics that we've used for that diagnosis have changed across time. It was first diagnosed, or at least given official criteria, in 1956, that changed in 1978, changed again in 1980, changed again in 1987, and then we've been working with the last definition since 94. Each time it changed, it sort of, sometimes it got more inclusive, counted more kids. Sometimes it got more exclusive, left out more kids. And people can argue either way right now about whether the criteria for that diagnosis is really including more kids or excluding more kids. Most of this population studies that we do when we tell you how many children have autism or autism spectrum disorder are based on what are called prevalence data. And prevalence data sort of says, this is how many people in the population have this disorder. And sometimes that isn't completely accurate. In part, it will be less accurate if the disease condition lapses. So if I count how many of you right now have autism, you may not count even though you had it when you were 4 years old, because you may have recovered from autism. We have some recovery with very intensive therapies, and we even have some that are just what we sort of call spontaneous recovery. And so that condition may not last your entire lifetime. It also is the case that we can underestimate the population in older people if this is a condition which causes an increase in mortality. And yeah, kids with autism spectrum disorder do tend to have more accidents, drownings, and some other things that would tend to reduce their ability to live a full lifespan. The other thing we worry about is, are we really counting all the cases that are out there? And it depends on whose data you use, whether you're getting all the cases or not. And some people speculate that, in fact, we probably are underestimating the rate of autism, because studies where they've almost gone door to door to identify children, as they did in Brick Township, New Jersey, actually got the highest rates for kids having autism, for example. And if we haven't done that, we've just depended on health department statistics or education department statistics, we might not really be seeing everyone or counting everyone. And autism is not exactly a label that's taken lightly. Schools don't like to put it on children. Parents don't like to get it on their children. They may resist that label as well. And there's been a lot of debate both ways. This isn't real. It's a matter of increased awareness. It's a matter of changes in how we're diagnosing. You're including more people now. And other people saying, no, we're not. We're excluding a lot of people. However, in the last couple of years, most of the literature that I read is concluding that the increases are real. In part, there may be some increase because of greater awareness and because of change in diagnosis, but it's, you cannot explain a tenfold increase because of those factors. And so we're working now on the assumption that these increases are real. So if that's the case, then what's causing the increase? And that's really what we're here to talk about today. There's currently no biological marker, no distinctive or particular biological signature that serves as a benchmark for autism diagnosis. But the problem is huge. Huge enough that Congress has given it attention in hearings and has started to provide massive funding for this. In the year 2000, they increased funding for research in autism by 5 times, which raised it to $52 million. In the year 2006, they authorized $945 million to be spent across the next 5 years on research and treatment of autism. Sometimes it's the funding that causes this. Sometimes it's the problem that causes this. But we have been in just a feverish search for this cause. This quote says it all. Any number of speculative factors, such as minute amounts of mercury preservative in vaccines, yeast infection of the gastrointestinal tract, allergy to gluten or casein, and others are widely and uncritically accepted despite the lack of convincing scientific proof. I know Amy Finkel's here tonight. Stand up, Amy. I know you're up there. Amy's the parent of Josh, who appears in many of these photos. Josh is a much older boy right now, but he was awfully cute then, and still pretty cute. But Amy said this to me more than 10 years ago. She said, you know, I will try anything for the treatment of my child. If I can cure or relieve his autism, I will try anything. I'm using applied behavior analysis because I know that's effective. But I will swim with the dolphins if that's going to cure my child. But she said, what I wish that science would do for me is tell me, what is the probability of this particular cure working, and what are the risks that I'm exposing my child to? So since that time, Amy, that's what I've been trying to do in terms of reading the literature. Now, Amy wants to know what treatments are effective, but I discovered I can't go to that place until I go back to what are the causes. You can't talk about cure until you know what causes. I know some effective treatment, but I also wanted to look at what biomedical people were searching out in terms of the cures. So what we're kind of going on here is a little detective trip. And like any detective trip, you're going to follow the clues. And some clues are going to lead you to other clues. That's a good thing. Some clues are going to be red herrings. And you're going to chase them down, and it will be meaningless. And some clue at some point in time will probably lead us to findings that will be helpful to us. This was advertised as searching for the cause of autism. If you read the cover when you came in the door, I said searching for the causes of autism, because I think it will be much like the cause of cancer. There are lots of different cancer, probably lots of different causes. We're talking about autism spectrum disorder, lots of different forms of autism, probably lots of different environmental and genetic factors involved. I also want to sort out for you the quality of the science. Green and Perry described these categories very well. They said that there's science, which is very logical. It is empirically tested. Not only do I have to prove it, someone not related to me has to prove it. We have to be able to replicate it, see it occur again and again in order to say, yes, that's scientifically sound. That's most of what I'm presenting to you tonight. That might not cover your favorite theory. It might not even go along with your personal experience, and I apologize, because I may inflame you. I may say, no, that what you believe in your heart is true. I don't have any science to support. And I don't do that to annoy you. I'm just trying to sort out for you, this is where the good science is. This is where we've had enough studies to say this is sound. There also is pseudoscience. Pseudoscience uses a lot of jargon, uses a lot of testimony, endorsements. Sounds pretty sophisticated, and it's very hard for someone like me as an educator to sort that out from the real science, and that's why I've been working so closely with Don Calbreath, who can bring in a biochemical background on that. And then there's just plain anti-science, rejects the facts, relies on personal interpretation. We're not going there at all tonight. And we're going to stay away from pseudoscience as much as we can, though there may be some involved. These are what we've identified as the three major routes that the detectives are taking. There are scientists who are exploring brain neuropathology. The brain is sick in some way, and maybe that's what's causing autism. There are some scientists who are following a track which is called the opioid excess theory. And in that theory really talks about certain toxins which are passing through the blood-brain barrier and affecting, causing autism. And a lot of what you're probably interested in is related to that theory, and that has to do with vaccinations, the gluten casein implications, allergies, immune reactions, and so on. We'll talk about a couple of those. We can't go down all of those routes here tonight. And then the third major way that people are looking for the cause of autism is in genetic research. So let's start with neuropathology, and that's divided really into two parts. Some of the science is looking at the structure of the brain, sort of the physical structure and the tissue that's in the brain. And some scientists are looking at how the brain works or the brain function. So we'll start with the brain structure. One of the theories regarding brain structure has to do with what's called synaptic pruning. Now, as you and I were developing, there is a normal brain process in which some of our nerve cells or neurons in the brain tissue die off. The weaker or less efficient ones may die off so that the whole transmission of messages between neurons can be more efficient and more effective. This theory suggests that perhaps in children with autism, that's not happening. Those cells are not being pruned away. And if that were the case, then we would see larger brain size. And even though when we look at brain structure, if you just visually looked at the brain, it looks the same as anybody else's brain. It has the same major components and so on. But we have found that it is larger. About a quarter of children with autism have head circumferences that put them at the 97th percentile. That's a very high rate of children with larger heads. This larger size is not present at birth, but their brains grow very rapidly, and particularly between the ages of 2 to 12. Brain volume is also significantly larger for children with autism who are under the age of 12. I actually asked Don, how do you measure brain volume? And he looked at me and said, it's too complicated to explain to you. So I just taking his word at it. But there probably are some people here that could explain it to us. They are also heavier by 100 to 200 grams in children with autism. But conversely, adults with autism, their brains are lighter in weight. So this very rapid growth occurs at one period of time and then stops. The evidence that we have on brain structure really comes from two places. One is postmortem examination, which means we autopsy the brain, but we can only do that on dead brains. Okay. Now we're starting to get more information using magnetic resonance imaging or MRIs, in which we can kind of get a picture of the brain, or at least of brain activity. Both of these have allowed us to see that there is increased cortical thickness in the brains of children with autism, might contribute to increased gray matter volume and total brain size. When we look at brain tissue itself in individuals with autism, we also find some differences. There's a 60% reduction in the Purkinje cells of the cerebellum. Now, I want you to remember Purkinje. We'll come back to Purkinje cells again. These are actually some of the largest neurons in the brain. And they're also fairly easily affected by toxins and autoimmune diseases and so on. The Purkinje cells are important for circuitry of the brain, the synaptic connections. There's a gap between our neurons, and we carry messages through biochemicals between those gaps. And the Purkinje cells are vital to that. They also have found that these tissue differences may be caused during the first trimester of gestation, during the first 3 months of pregnancy. When we've looked at autopsy brains, and these were the brains of males between 10 and 44 years of age who had autism, we found unusually few neurons in the amygdala. And that's a structure that's involved in emotion and memory. Now, we have to be careful about how we interpret the evidence that we have on brain structure. We can really only directly look at the brain through autopsy. And we really have very few brains of people who have autism that are available for research. The Harvard Brain Bank is always trying to get more donations of brain tissue so that we can increase what we have available for research. And one of the saddest things is that most of these studies I've cited were done when the only autistic brains that we had were from young adults. None were from children younger than 5 years of age. And yet we expect the symptoms to show up before 3 years of age. So we really haven't had a lot of brain tissue available from infants and toddlers with autism to really see what's happening during that time when this is probably when we're seeing this growth and so on. When you have brains that are used in autopsy, they don't come with detailed medical histories. And so it's hard to know what environmental factors might be involved, and especially given the fact that most people with autism spectrum disorders are going to be on medications. We don't know how the drugs may have affected the brain tissue that we're seeing or even the brain growth. And when we are looking at live brains, our technology is very new, and we still have to be a little bit cautious about the assumptions we make from the pictures that we're getting. We don't always know exactly what they mean. Other theories about this have to do with brain function. And a new one which has developed is the theory about underconnectivity. Now, when you and I do a task or try to solve a problem, many parts of our brain are working at the same time and are probably communicating with each other. And we say that we're integrating that information. But what we worry about with children with autism is that that communication might be impaired between different parts of the brain. And that would especially disrupt some of our higher level functioning. We can now do what are called functional MRIs. This is a living person who's given an MRI. We give them a task to do while they're in the MRI, and we can measure where activity is occurring in the brain, especially those areas we would expect to interconnect for information. And here's actually a slide which is taken from researchers at Yale University. They've shown what happens to the brain in an autistic person versus what happens in the brain of a person who does not have autism. So you see in the healthy control, a lot of colored areas, and there's an area circled in red. All of that area would be activated when we see that kind of activity occurring. But on the other side, you see the brain with autism, where fewer parts of the brain are activated. So, and that would support that theory of underconnectivity. We also, when we look at brain function, have some questions about seizure activity. And the activity that we question most is epileptiform activity. Epileptiform just means like epilepsy. And what is occurring is that we are seeing brain waves which look a lot like seizure waves inside brains of children with autism who are not having seizures. So I'm not exactly sure how to call this, an underlying seizure condition, a pre-seizure kind of condition. When we did EEGs, electroencephalograms, where you're sort of wired and we can measure electrical activity in the brain, we found that about half of children with autism had seizures, and about 20% more had this epileptiform activity, even though they'd never had seizures. They still had something like seizuring going on in their brain. We do find the rate of seizures is much higher for those who have severe cognitive deficiencies. So if you're autistic and also severely mentally retarded, you tend to have a higher rate of seizures. And in a study of children who were normal at birth and then lost their abilities, regressed, we found that 82% of them had epileptiform activity. Not seizures, but the brain waves look like seizures, even though 70% of them had never had any reported seizures. So what we're really wondering about seizures is it a coincidence? Seizures and autism occur together. Is it a cause? Do these seizures cause autistic behavior? Or perhaps it's the result of the epilepsy. We just really, really don't know which. And we have to be cautious about looking at seizure activity and its data. When a physician does a study, you've probably seen an ad in the newspaper that came out. If you have asthma and you've been using an inhaler for 3 years, would you be willing to be a volunteer in this particular study? Well, physicians pass the word, and we recruit subjects to be in our studies. And it may be that subjects who've been recommended for this kind of research, it could be their own family doctors were suspecting some epileptic activity already and sent them in for the studies and so on. It could be that other damage to the brain is causing both the seizures and the autism. Another question that we have with brain function has to do with serotonin. And the theory or the question we're trying to ask there is there too much serotonin in the brain? Serotonin functions as a neurotransmitter in the brain. Serotonin also works in other systems, in the blood and in the intestinal tract, in other places in the body. But in the brain, it works as a neurotransmitter. And the theory is perhaps you have too high a level of serotonin in the brain. Such abnormality might explain some symptoms of autism, including the sleeplessness, depressed mood, compulsive behaviors. So let's look at the evidence for this. We have found a number of abnormalities in the blood, urine, and even the cerebral spinal fluid of individuals with autism in terms of abnormalities in of serotonin. And one finding which has actually been replicated pretty consistently is about a third of the individuals with autism have had increased serotonin in their blood platelets. But we haven't linked that to any particular characteristic of autism. It's not like that one third have something different about their autism than other people. We know that serotonin regulates mood, sleep, sensory perception, stimulation of the gastrointestinal smooth muscles, and those are all things that are a little bit more complicated when you have autism. When we have done positron emission tomography, PET scans, we measured the chemical activity within an organ. We have demonstrated some abnormality in the serotonin metabolism as related to those pesky Purkinje cells. We also have found in another study that the serotonin transporter gene, HTT, appears to be different in children with autism. Not all children with autism, but different enough from a normal population to be suspect to us. They're likely to have a shortened form of the DNA that serves as an on-ramp that helps express that gene. This doesn't mean that HTT gene causes autism, but it might be associated. And it's associated with serotonin. When we have children with autism, they're often treated by being given selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs. Those include Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft. And we've done that to reduce the frequency of repetitive and ritualized behaviors. So very often they've responded to that. What is contrary, though, is that we use those drugs when you have low serotonin levels, not when you have high serotonin levels. So it's a complicated picture. That seems to be a paradox. Why would that be occurring? Our greatest caution or concern with this theory is that conventional medicine, conventional science, doesn't believe that serotonin actually crosses the blood-brain barrier. The blood-brain barrier are membranes in the vessels that don't allow those hormones to cross over, especially serotonin, because it's got a different job when it's in the brain than when it's in the intestine or when it's in the blood. And so we really don't believe it crosses the blood-brain barrier. So we shouldn't see, we shouldn't have high excess serotonin in the brain bleeding into the blood system. That shouldn't happen. That shouldn't cause those platelets to have more serotonin there. And also, we said before, serotonin works with a lot of different organ systems, and it does regulate mood, sleep, sensory perception, gastrointestinal smooth muscles. Maybe the serotonin is higher in the blood platelets because of other functions it has in the body, not necessarily in the brain, because it works in several different organ systems. And we also have a difficulty with serotonin because when we study other mental health disorders like depression and schizophrenia and anxiety and almost any kinds of stress that you put on that part of our organ system, we see low serotonin just pervasively across all those systems. So we've come to start to speculate it's not serotonin that causes those problems. Those problems cause low rates of serotonin. When you're under anxiety, perhaps that's what's causing the abnormality in the serotonin. And autism could be a very stressful condition that might change your serotonin levels. Oh, I just stopped working. Okay, there we go. So we're going to move out now away from the brain structure, brain function research, and we're going to talk a little bit about the opioid excess theory. The opioid excess theory suggests that autism spectrum disorder can result from the incomplete breakdown and excessive absorption of gut-derived peptides from foods. Peptides are molecules. When they're large enough, they're called proteins. And it's easiest for me to remember this by leaky gut syndrome, which actually is a term used in a lot of the studies. And that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about the intestinal wall being abnormally permeable and allowing large molecules to pass, which would pass into the blood system, which supposedly then would pass from the blood system to the brain. Remembering all along that there are people who would argue this, most conventional science doesn't believe that you can pass through those barriers. These large proteins shouldn't be able to. It's suggested that those proteins would have morphine-like qualities, which would... And that results from the incomplete digestion of things like casein and gluten. And that these would give you a range of symptoms. Now, in fact, in a study where they took blood from newborn babies and then later analyzed the blood after they knew what their outcomes were, they found that for children who later developed autism and mental retardation, there were higher levels of neuropeptides and neurotrophins in their blood. In fact, 99% of the children with autism, 97% of those with mental retardation showed excessive levels of at least one group of neuropeptides, whereas children with cerebral palsy, different kind of disability, physical disability, did not show that. Normal children did not show those levels. They've also found in the urine of individuals with autism, 70 to 80% of them had large amounts of substances with chemical properties similar to what you would expect out of these opioid peptides. And it's been argued that the symptoms of autism might be like the effects of chronic morphine dosages. However, that's also being debated. There's quite a list of side effects you could have. And some might seem like autism, but there are a lot of others like tremors and nausea and things that are not showing up. So it's really debated about whether autism has those same symptoms. It's a question on how significant is this pathway? Does it exist? Can these large proteins pass the blood-brain barrier? And we really question whether peptides in the urine tell us anything about what's in the brain. You really are talking about getting through several kinds of barriers if it were really from the brain or going to the brain. Again, a lot of these studies have been based on volunteers. It kind of put the word out. If you bring in your child, I'd like to test the urine and see. That's not what we call the gold standard in medical research. The gold standard is you take everybody who comes, they're randomly assigned, I don't even know who's who, then I do the test, then I tell you how the groups came out. That's not exactly how this kind of research has been done. A lot of it has become public, but not in peer-reviewed journals where other professionals have taken a close look at the science and the methods used. They've been presented in posters, they've been presented in lectures, but they haven't come under careful scrutiny of other professionals and scientists. So we question some of the data. However, it's an important theory because these are the causes that are related to this theory. Vaccinations, casein and gluten in the diet, yeast infections, secretin as a treatment, organophosphorus pesticides, which is Agent Orange, and immune reactions. They all would be explained through this leaky gut syndrome. So we're just going to talk about vaccinations and about casein and gluten. I think most people here would be interested in those too. There's a lot of information on the others as well. Many parents report their child's regression occurred shortly after vaccination for measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR, which is multiple vaccines given in one shot. And Wakefield was a researcher who hypothesized that exposure to measles could cause a chronic intestinal inflammation. That inflammation might change the permeability of the tissues and allow these large proteins to pass and allow neurotoxins to get to the brain. Now, on a second route with vaccinations, vaccines used to contain dimerazole. It's an organic mercury compound, ethyl mercury. And that was hypothesized to be associated with neurodevelopmental disorders. Now, we have to be careful because this organic compound is ethyl mercury. The science that we know where we have neurodevelopmental disorders is methyl mercury, which is a different compound. So we already sort of took a leap of faith there. Wakefield reported that he found many intestinal abnormalities among children who had severe developmental delay, including autism spectrum disorder there. However, other researchers have not found the same findings. They're questioning his results because they have not found unusual rates of these abnormal intestinal problems. In Britain, 700 families have sued pharmaceutical companies for damage to their children from vaccines. In the United States is now in hearings, we have 4,800 claims that have been filed by parents who believe that the vaccinations caused their children's autism. And their primary concern has been because their children first showed symptoms very close in time to when they received their immunizations. The great difficulty there is that prior to school age, children are now receiving 33 or more different immunizations. It's very hard, and a vast majority of those before the age of 3. It's very hard to go for very many months at a time without your child getting a vaccination. So it's hard to sort out the timing in that case. A British study concluded there was no link between autism and the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And basically what they did was they laid out the rate at which children were getting MMR vaccinations and the rate at which autism was increasing. And they don't follow the same curve. MMR vaccine has been fairly stable, and autism has continued to increase pretty rapidly. The American Academy of Pediatrics concluded there was no causal connection. And in fact, now we've had really quite a campaign to be sure that you get your children vaccinated. A lot of people are reluctant to do that because of this question about whether autism has been caused by vaccinations. I think, unfortunately, I've been in the business 40 years, right? Well, I remember when we didn't have vaccinations for all of these things, and I remember the disabilities that were caused by the diseases themselves. Measles and mumps and rubella are very dangerous diseases, and most of you have never seen them. We also have a lot of evidence now that makes it appear that the abnormal brain development is occurring before 30 weeks gestation, or even earlier, even in the first trimester of gestation, of pregnancy. That's a long time. That's much earlier than children are getting the vaccinations. And increases in autism occurred long after the introduction of MMR vaccine in the United States. And though autism has increased, vaccination rates have remained pretty steady. A very dramatic study reported data from Japan. Japan actually suspended the use of their MMR vaccinations because they had some problems with the mumps component of that vaccine. And they have very interesting data. What you see on the yellow line are the rate of children getting the MMR vaccine. And you'll see it drops. In 1992, it dropped all the way down to zero, and they just stopped giving the vaccine, MMR vaccine. What you see in green is the children who have autism in the form of regression, who started normally and then lost their skills. In red, you see children with just autism, and in bright blue, you see children with any kind of disorder on the autism spectrum. And those continue to increase even when none of the children were getting MMR vaccine. This was a very large study. They also have reported almost no link between thimerosal and autism. Controls receiving vaccines with no thimerosal are still showing increasing rates of autism. And we have removed thimerosal from most of the vaccinations. There's still a couple that have a little bit of thimerosal in them, and there may be some trace amount due to processing, but pretty much that's not in our vaccinations any longer. The conclusions on this research that the science supports is that internationally we found no association between MMR vaccine and autism spectrum disorder, and in fact, what is most worrisome to us is that children are not being vaccinated. Now, I know that a lot of you have heard about a recent court case which found for the parents and funded their case. However, if you look carefully at the details of that case, it did not prove that vaccinations cause autism. That's not why they were funded. It also is the case that those courts do not have to have the same level of scientific proof that the science community requires. They have to show that there's some plausibility for a connection. And in that case, the child had a mitochondrial disorder. She was given five vaccines in one shot. The argument to the court was that the multiple vaccines reduced her immunity, which caused the mitochondrial disorder to be triggered, which resulted in symptoms like autism. However, honestly, the scientific community does not support that finding, because those vaccines should have, if anything, helped strengthen the immune system rather than weaken it. So that's a very controversial case. It's raised hopes of a lot of people who have felt their personal experience really tells them that the vaccinations are involved. And we're going to just see lots and lots of fallout from that case. But as far as the science goes, it doesn't support it. And just along here, I wanted to throw in, what about mercury in the environment? What about that methyl mercury? We have had a few studies which have shown correlation between the Environmental Protection Agency's reported rates of mercury in the environment and the increasing numbers of students being diagnosed with autism in special education. There have been about three large cities where we've seen that correlation. Now, the caution there is, we've also seen a correlation between watching more TV and autism. They might just be coincidental. We don't know. But you kind of have to wonder, if you're worried about trace amounts of ethyl mercury, maybe we should be more worried about methyl mercury in our environment. Okay. Let's talk about casein and gluten. This is still the opioid excess theory. 70 to 80% of those with autism had large amounts of abnormal peptides in the urine. Casein from milk, gluten from wheat and other cereal products can produce those substances. So that's how the theory goes. So many families are using a casein and gluten elimination diet. That means you're not feeding your children wheat products and you're not feeding your children milk products. In fact, I would guess that we traveled around the United States visiting effective treatment centers, and every treatment center except for one reported that pretty much every student in their classes were on some kind of elimination diet. We also visited one highly effective treatment that did not allow their students to be on elimination diets, and their children were functioning very well, thank you. The difficulty is that the results really are inconclusive. There haven't been good controlled studies in the past. There have been a couple just recently where the researchers actually prepared all the food so the parents didn't know whether their kids were getting casein and gluten or not. And the researchers didn't know whether they were giving casein or gluten products to the children. However, even they had to rely on what parent reports said about how their child's behavior had improved and so on. And there were conflicting reports. There were some parents who said, my child is so much better, and then we're told, you know, you weren't on the elimination diet. They were just inconclusive, so I don't know at this point whether this is indicated or not. Peptides in the urine are not a good measure of neurochemistry. Children with autism, the difficulty is they tend to have pretty limited food preferences anyway. And my experience has been a lot of beige and white foods. I don't know if the rest of you agree with that. And now if I'm cutting out wheat and milk, I've eliminated a lot of what they're willing to eat. And we worry now about nutritional defects with that. I think if you're really concerned, you should have your child tested to see if you have any evidence of gluten or casein intolerance. But I don't think you should just say, wow, this is something I can do. I can control this diet. I'll just do it. It may not be a risk worth taking. Let's talk about genetic research. Autism spectrum disorders are categorized. They're either idiopathic, which means this is all I have that's wrong with me is the autism, or they're secondary, I actually have a verifiable disorder like Rett syndrome or something, and I'm showing a lot of autism characteristics, about 10% of our cases today, because actually we eliminate a lot of them from that category of autism by genetic testing. Secondary autism, those symptoms might show up with Fragile X, tuberous sclerosis, phenylketonuria, fetal alcohol syndrome, Angelman syndrome, Rett syndrome, Smith-Lemli-Opitz syndrome. And that does make us interested in genetics because we have identified genes for those particular disorders that have some characteristics of autism. We're also using sort of two major strategies. One is to say, aha, this gene has to do with something that has been affected by autism. For example, we think this gene controls language, so let's study it and see if that gene is normal in kids who have autism. That's one approach. The other approach is to take families, especially families where they have more than one child with autism, and say, let's do a genetic scan on you and see if your karyotypes look different from other people's. Let's see if your genotypes look different from people who don't have autism to see if we can find the gene that might lead to that. We don't know what the actual genetic mechanism involved might be, but we suspect that it's more than one. It's likely to be several genes, and they might even create a predisposition that something in the environment then triggers and causes autism. I'll talk a little bit about why we think that might be the case. If we just looked at patterns for inheritance, if I have a dominant gene, I typically express the gene. That means you see the characteristics. If one parent has a dominant gene, which I might inherit it from my mom or from my dad, or I might not, it would mean half of our kids would express that. So if autism were caused by a dominant gene, then half my children would have autism. And that's not the case. One out of 150 on the spectrum, that's not even close. If it were a recessive gene, meaning in order to show this trait, I'd actually have to get a recessive gene from both my parents, then one out of four of my children would have autism if I had the recessive gene and my husband had the recessive gene and we produced these children. And that's not even close. We just don't show those kinds of patterns, so that may suggest to us that more than one gene is involved, that it really takes a combination of genes to get the right condition. We're also thinking that there might be a couple things going on with genetic inheritance. We might have a family that's never had autism in their family, and then the gene becomes mutated. And even though it hasn't been in my past, my children might express autism. And typically, this mutation would be passed on by the females. If you're a female, you have an X chromosome and an X chromosome. And if you have a gene on one X that's disordered, you very likely have a gene that's functioning on the other X, and it'll take over. And so you may not show any of those traits. But if you're male, you have an XY. So if you have a problem with a gene on the X chromosome, you don't have a similar one on the Y chromosome to take over. So you will express the trait. And that's why we have so many more males in special education than females. That's a simple explanation. I hope it's accurate. So if a mutation occurred on the X chromosome, I might not show that as a female, but I might pass it on to my child. We suspect some have said 5 to 6 major genes. Some said as many as 30 genes might be involved in this. It's unlikely that the genes act alone. They probably interact with environmental factors. In twin studies, where we had a set of identical twins, and at least one had autism, only about half the time has the other child also had autism. Now, we're talking about identical twins. We should have the same genes. We have the same genes if we're identical twins. Why would one have autism and the other not, unless there's an environmental factor? And then on the other hand, even when we had same-sex fraternal twins, we're not identical, we actually never found the other half of that pair to have autism. Now, I don't know why that's the case, because siblings do have a higher possibility of having autism. Just in this particular study, that's how it came out. Probability the next-born sibling of an autistic child will have autism is about 3 to 6 out of 100. That's much, much higher than chance. So again, it tells us probably genetics is involved, but not strictly genetics. And there's a 4 to 1 preponderance of males with autism, which usually implies that the sex chromosome is involved. Certain other genetic disorders have high rates of autism. We named some of those earlier. And then the study on thalidomide was very, very interesting. How many of you remember thalidomide? A few of you do. Thalidomide was a drug that was given to reduce nausea in pregnant women in the 60s, 50s, 60s. And then we later found that it had a very high probability of also producing missing limbs and some very severe physical disabilities. Well, it also could produce autism. So we have some children who have autism because of prenatal exposure to thalidomide. And those children, we know when mom was prescribed to have thalidomide. And we have identified in those children a particular fold in the earlobe. This is a very interesting kind of study, a little fold in the earlobe that would have occurred at about 3 to 4 weeks gestation, the first month of pregnancy, when this fold in the earlobe occurred among children who had thalidomide-caused autism. Well, what's very interesting is that we also found that other children with autism had a very high rate of having this fold in the earlobe, even though they had never been exposed to thalidomide, which made us believe that it must occur, that environmental factor must impact very early in pregnancy. Just very, very recently, we've identified one gene that's definitely been associated with idiopathic autism, and it made big headlines, and we have found the gene that causes autism in 1% of the cases of autism. Okay. However, we have identified at least one gene linked abnormality on every chromosome in the body. So we're still in an ocean trying to find that gene. Typically, what we do is what you really are hearing about are candidate genes. What you will read in the headlines in Newsweek and so on is this gene is involved in autism. What it really means is this is a candidate gene, meaning we're going to look closely and study this gene because it's related to some function that's affected by autism. So it is like that. If we know this affects language, we'll study it. And then suddenly the headline reads, language gene causes autism. That's not really the case. We don't have any idea yet. And most often, most often, what is the case is that we are going to look at genes that affect neurotransmitters, that affect language or socialization, or that affect early brain development. That was that thalidomide gene told us it might be very early. And we have to be careful then, because we might just be misled. We might be following that trail and not find it. Now I'm going backwards, sorry. If a gene is associated with autism, we're not sure what that means. Might not be causal. But I will just recite for you a few genes, and I'm not going to go into depth on this. This is too much to absorb in one sitting. But the X chromosome, the sex chromosome, because dramatically more males than females have autism. We also think that genes on the X chromosome affect social interaction. That's been an important one. And we also have a gene there that's been associated with Rett's disorder. And we have genes on the X chromosome that affect neurotransmission, so it makes it a good candidate to study. We've looked at chromosome number 2 because there are genes there that are associated with language development, and there are genes there that affect the gastrointestinal function. That's one of those clues that we need to follow. We've looked at chromosome number 3 because there's a gene there that helps produce a neurotransmitter, and there's a gene there that helps in brain development. We looked at chromosome 15 because we have found some abnormalities among families where there's a high rate of autism. And we also found 3 different GABA genes, which are all neurotransmitters, carrying those messages in the brain. We've looked at a gene called HOXA1 quite closely because of the knowledge of its timing. It's a development gene. It actually turns on other genes, and it does it at 3 to 4 weeks gestation, that very early period. It modulates the other activities of genes. It lives on chromosome 7, and chromosome 7 has had a lot of variance in families that have high rates of autism. But even so, those variants have shown up in about 20% of people who don't have autism and only in about 40% of people who do. So even though it's got a little higher rate, it's not huge. But on chromosome 7, we've looked at that gene that affects early formation of the brain, development of the hindbrain, language processing, language delays, fetal development of brain cells. All of those have made that gene come to our attention. We've looked at chromosome 17 because there's that transporter gene for serotonin is there. We've also have a neurotransmitter gene there, another one that interacts on serotonin levels, and synaptic inhibition, which would have to do with neurotransmission. The conclusion on genes at this point is that the evidence from many studies suggests that inherited factors are largely responsible for the occurrence of autism-related disorders. However, it is equally clear that genetics cannot fully account for the development of autism. So we are still at the point where we do know children who recover from autism, especially with intensive early intervention, sometimes spontaneously. But we do not know a cause of autism, so we cannot call those cures. The term cure implies removal of the original cause of the problem. Because the cause of autism is unknown, claiming a cure would certainly be unjustified and unethical. And that brings me to the end of this presentation. Thank you. I know a lot of you are really interested, more interested in treatment now because you have a child or working with children. I hope a year from now we'll be able to bring you some of the science on that. But now you kind of have a background, and I hope that you will be maybe a bit more cynical as you look at the possible cures that are and causes that are claimed. I know a lot of you need to go. It is, I think, Whitworth Idol tonight. If you will please let your neighbors exit, and if you have questions, come on down to the front. We'll do a little transition. Thank you. Thank you. That's beautiful.